Ted Klein. 3, 2, 1. Hello and welcome to The Green Room. I'm your host, John Tibbetts. And of course, as you know, who listen regularly to this program, periodically we like to interview writers in the fields of dark fantasy, horror, and science fiction. This time around, I'm coming to you from the Upper West Side of New York City. I'm in the apartment of Ted Klein, whose novel The Ceremonies from Viking Press caused such a stir just within a recent year or so, and a collection of short stories, Dark Gods, recently has a representative story winning an award from the World Fantasy Convention. We'll be getting to all of that, but just very quickly, Ted, people who have seen your name on Viking Press covers and jackets, it says Ted, but it's T-E-D, initials. So what's the story there, first of all?
That's largely affectation, but I'd rather leave it a little mysterious. I can say that if you look at my birth certificate, you'll see Theodore Donald Klein, and the E, well, that can stand for anything you like.
Ted Klein, coming to you from New York City, I have to say, if this were a television program, while you're talking, the camera could be having a great time prowling around these rooms. The books, the artifacts, the mementos. I'm wondering if you could give us a brief verbal description of some of your favorite pet toys, items, memorabilia surrounding us.
Well, let's see. There's a table of frogs we're looking at. A frog that's standing and looks a bit like a Batrachian idol that one might pray to, and a frog that looks like it's proposing. Behind me is a tarantula in glass and a glass globe, and on the bottom of the base, I happen to know, is a little warning against consuming the contents of that glass.
Indeed.
In case somebody got so hungry they wanted to eat the tarantula. I'm looking at a little statuette of H.P. Lovecraft figure Wilbur Whately on my bookshelf there. He's carrying a carpet bag and holding the dread Necronomicon in his hand, and that's a book of magical spells, in a sense, that Lovecraft made up and enjoys a kind of underground reputation.
And from the ceiling, we've got lighter-than-air aircraft.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And a strange little cut-up devilfish there that looks a bit like a dried Martian.
And the more we have read your stories, the more we begin to find a kind of appropriateness to a lot of these elements around the house. For example, the figure from the ceiling, may I cite the book Black Man with a Horn? That seems to be kind of appropriate.
Yes. Well, also, I would say my stories are a bit cluttered, and certainly this apartment is pretty cluttered, isn't it?
Also, one of the great private book collections I've ever seen. Do you spend a certain amount of each week ransacking bookstores, and are there special things you look for, or do you just let it all happen?
I used to have the problem that I couldn't walk past a bookshop without going in and buying something. I think Parkinson's law has finally done me in. I've begun to slack off now.
Well, don't you think it's almost a kind of disease? I have it too.
Yeah, it is. As a matter of fact, I wish that I could acquire a book on the lure of book collecting and collecting in general. I'd sort of like to know what's behind it.
People have tried it, like Vincent Sterrett, but somehow even Vince didn't quite bring it off. There's a special magic there that's elusive.
I'm sure that it's sexual at base, like everything else. But
something oral about it, I suppose, too. Okay, now, when you collect all these books, do you find that to have them around you while you work becomes an unnecessary distraction, or do you want it that way?
Well, personally, I can't write at all unless I read a little bit first to prime the pump, as some people say. Mm-hmm. So I very much depend on other books. Also, the horror genre, I think, is a very tradition conscious genre. There aren't that many famous books in the field, and I think most readers have read them all. I think there's a sense of what has gone before. It's hard to imagine somebody really writing well who has never read his predecessors.
I'm wondering if there's something unique in the field in that regard. It does presuppose a greater experience with the predecessors, the works that came before.
I think it may have something to do with the limited number of horror plots there probably are.
Yes.
You know, it's hard to invent really many new things that are scary. I guess what's important is your treatment of them. And for that reason, I think it might help to sort of know how earlier writers have treated the same kind of basic human fears.
Even if some of our listeners have not read your books, blast their eyes. Even if that's the case, they may know your name from the Twilight Zone magazine. Let's do a little bit updating on that. How long now were you with the magazine, and how long have you been gone?
Okay, well, I was the founding editor, you might say, of the magazine, and it premiered in the spring of 1981, and I finally left it a bit burnt out in the spring of 85. After about, I think, 40 issues or something like that.
Does it become kind of like the horn in that story I mentioned before, the black man with the horn? It kind of sucks it all out of you, a venture like that.
Well, it certainly took up all my time. I mean, I was literally sleeping at the office in the early stages, mm-hmm. and there was a big leather couch that I would sometimes, you know, sleep on. And I was, if I was coming home, I was coming home at, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning, trembling with fatigue, and then getting up, you know, and rushing back. It's sort of amazing because when I look at those issues now, I think, God, how amateurish they are, and I don't even think they show all the hours that went into them. But unfortunately, the hours did.
What was the best thing that came out of those years with the magazine, from your point of view?
Meeting lots of very, very good people in the field. I'll tell you, working with writers and illustrators taught me one thing that may sound a little shocking, and that is how much nicer and more pleasant illustrators are than writers in general.
Yeah. Indeed. I know you're thinking of Gay and Wilson, for example.
Charming fellow, but also, of course, for Twilight Zone, he was a writer. Sure. He manages to be both and do them splendidly. But God, writers are an egotistical bunch, you know, and backbiting and hard to deal with. And whereas I don't know, I found the artists really charming.
Mm-hmm. What about the correspondence that you must have had to maintain, especially as you went through revisions of articles and stories? Did all of that become time consuming too?
Oh, very much. I mean, I could spend an entire day of the week just answering mail. And I'm not thinking necessarily even dealing with writers, but we had, of course, our usual quota of crank readers. You know, we got weird threats. We got invitations to join various religious cults. You know, we got true life accounts of saucer and, you know, saucer meetings and so forth. I guess it's the name Twilight Zone attracts a lot.
As long as they write and not come down to the offices.
I used to be quite nervous about that. Well, the office the office actually had a lot of security, but no, I think most of these people seem to come out of the Midwest and the West.
Yes, there you go.
Fortunately.
Now, in dealing with all of the writers, were there a few new faces, new names that came to you, and as a result have done pretty well since then that you'd like to boast about maybe?
Well, I mean, three people that are emerging right now: David Scow and John Skip and Craig Spector. These are young horror writers who call themselves, quote, splatterpunks.
The kind of the Clive Barker type stuff.
A little bit, yeah. Not necessarily all to my taste, but nonetheless, they're popular and they're really talented and they're quite hot. There's Chet Williamson, another fellow that I think we published first. Then he appeared in short order in Playboy and The New Yorker, and now has a couple of books out.
Some of us, I guess, are tempted to think that when you left Twilight Zone magazine, the writing of The Ceremonies might have been the prime objective. Is that correct?
Well, actually, I had finished that somehow while I was at Twilight Zone. I did finally leave the magazine in order to write another book, which I'm working on now, sort of a horror novel set in New York, a sort of paranoid horror novel, which is, of course, easy to summon up here in the city.
Have you ever seen a Val Lewton film called Seventh Victim?
Oh, yes.
I keep thinking of Seventh Victim as a wonderful source for any writer interested in dealing with witchcraft in Greenwich Village as a typical.
Well, I'm sort of fascinated by the look of the, quote, Greenwich Village in the movie, because I assume it's a film set.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of generic Greenwich Village, and it's sort of especially dreamlike and charming for that reason. Just like the, I guess the sort of unnamed city where where Cat People is set. I guess it's supposed to be New York, but it doesn't exactly look like New York. Mm-hmm. And I've always wondered, in fact, what city it was.
Well, that golden age of the studio film literally created worlds for us. And they're worlds that we can't quite get a handle on. Therefore, how appropriate for a fantasy picture.
Also, even I used to be fascinated by the kind of Bavarian Cockney world that some of these old, you know, Frankenstein.
Universal pictures.
Yes, yes.
Well, the Universal back lot must have been an odd place indeed. We're talking to Ted Klein today here in the Green Room. Now, he's the author of The Ceremonies, a novel from Viking Press, a massive work. And it seems as if we are living in a day and age of 700 to 1,000 page plus fantasy and horror epics. Do you think with the advent of word processors that writers are turning out longer works?
I doubt that because I'm thinking of Gone with the Wind and Anthony Adverse and books like that. I think in my case, I can tell you The Ceremonies was probably big because it was a first novel, and I have a feeling that you know, with first novels everywhere, the writer tends to think, well, he'll never write another one. He better throw it all in, you know, and hope for the best. And that's sort of what I did.
Well, it came with a heavy set of accolades. I'm thinking of the famous incident in music history when Robert Schumann discovered Brahms, and he proclaimed to the world, here he is, the hope of German music. Here's this 19-year-old kid, Brahms, now with this on his shoulders. This relates to The Ceremonies, because Stephen King had a marvelous blurb attached to the jacket of The Ceremonies, which he just praised you to the skies. This is the finest gothic novel of this century or something like that.
I think it wasn't quite that wonderful. I think he may have said since Peter Straub's Ghost Story or something like that. It was very nice of him.
I'm curious about your reaction to that, though. Is there ever a debit side to having a major voice like that saying something like that about a first work?
Well, of course, it puts me in his debt, and I feel I am. For that.
Mm-hmm. And, have you had a chance to talk with him about the book itself?
I'm embarrassed talking with anybody about the book, actually. I tend to change the subject. And so I've had a chance to talk with King about other things, but not very much about the book.
Well, I'm on my mettle today, because I would like to talk about it a little bit, because it's such an important part of that book in which you reveal your own loves of literature. Through the main character of Ceremonies, we find a man who's struggling to write a doctoral dissertation on the gothic novel. I think you kind of have fun playing around with some of the titles for the dissertation.
Gosh, yes, but I'm embarrassed to say, I think you may remember
the importance of place in the gothic narrative or some such stuff like that. Let's first of all take that. Do you think that gothic fiction, late 18th century into the early 19th century, as wonderful as that stuff was, do you think that the scholars are ruining it by going into it for exhaustive papers?
I think it's nice that somebody is reading it, even if they're grad students, because I'm afraid otherwise that nobody would turn to that nowadays. And as I recall, because I did myself spend indeed a summer on a farm reading gothic novels, very much like the hero of The Ceremonies, These books that aren't very much read, except by people with lots of time on their hands, like I had at that time, and they're a bit unappreciated, and they're fun. Some of them are a lot of fun.
I'm curious about that summer. Did you find yourself surrounded by insects and in encroaching darkness and tree branches during that time, like in the book?
With a little exercise of the imagination, yes, of course. Absolutely, and I mean, while I love the country, I feel very much beleaguered whenever I'm there by insects and so forth. I'm the sort of person who goes to a cabin in the middle of Vermont and ends up sitting by the fireside and not venturing out, you know, except in the snow.
One of the amazing things about The Ceremonies, too, is that you show within just a few minutes of downtown New York City, you can uncover the most primeval kind of wilderness, and you aren't kidding about that.
Right. It's funny. Just this past weekend, I went for a drive in my new car out to the Jersey countryside, and it always amazes me how beautiful and bucolic and even secluded places can be out there. Yeah, within a short drive of New York City. It's encouraging to discover that.
And should we also not be surprised that a person could encounter, as our young man does in The Ceremonies, a kind of a religious cult of such almost pagan proportions?
I have to admit that was pretty well made up, and I honestly don't know. It would be nice to think that such cults could exist, you know, close to the city. Well, in a sense, there are odd religious cults right here in the city, right here on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. There are some very strange groups.
And you also like to indicate, in many respects, how Christianity feeds upon so many of the pagan systems that came before it, and how we really maybe should look at Christianity as an outgrowth of that, not necessarily something new.
I think I was a bit influenced by some of the things I'd been reading at the time and kind of playing with that theme a bit. I feel that others have done it better and more authoritatively. But yes, it was something that I sort of worked into the book.
Let's talk about some of those writers, and I think they must be kind of your heroes, especially Arthur Machen, the English writer into the teens and 20s. Remarkable writer. In fact, I bet there's a lot of interested listeners right now who are saying, Arthur Machen, what should I read of him if you recommend him?
Okay. He, interesting fellow, yes, largely unknown today, born in 1863, died the year I was born, 1947. He and I shared...
She lived longer than I thought.
Yes. He lived, I don't know, figure it out, 83 or something. Mm-hmm. I would recommend highly a longish short story of his called The White People, a very, very strange story, largely told from the point of view of a teenage girl who has odd experiences of kind of pagan magic in the woods outside her home.
And she's an adolescent, which is important.
Right. Well, there's a kind of undercurrent of sexuality there, too. It's a story that seems to be written from within the world of the supernatural, rather than merely observing it from outside, like most stories do. It has a feeling of authenticity about it. Very powerful. No real plot, just wonderful style, scary, thrilling. Written in a kind of hypnotic prose.
Oh, there's a hallucinatory quality. I myself have teased with the idea of reading The Hill of Dreams. Have you made it through that one?
Yes, and it's a wonderful book about it's actually very autobiographical because Machen was born in the Welsh Hills and journeyed to London as a teenager to be a writer, and starved for a while in a, not literally a garret, but pretty much that kind of lonely existence. And he wrote about that in The Hill of Dreams, the contrast between the unfriendly coldness of London and the memories of the Welsh Hills, where in fact the Roman legions had camped centuries before. It's a wonderful book, very special book, and many people find it their favorite novel.
Such is the power of his work. He was even able to make up a legend, and people accepted it as being the truth. You know the one I mean.
That's right, The Angels of Mons. Am I pronouncing that right?
I'm still working on the name Machen.
Okay.
Machen, Machen, Machen.
Yeah, it's right. It rhymes with Blacken or with Bracken.
Okay.
And although I'm sure that the Welsh may pronounce it more as you did with that sound,
yeah.
I suspect that one of the many reasons he's not read very much today is that people aren't sure how to pronounce his name.
Anyway, back to the ghostly bowman.
Oh, yeah. He, while a newspaper writer, wrote a short story about how the British forces, this is World War I, when pinned down and about to be overrun by the Germans, were miraculously saved by a ghostly legion of bowmen, of medieval English bowmen that came to their rescue. While this story was sheer fantasy, because it ran in a newspaper and because it apparently plugged into so many people's dreams and fears and wishes for the time, it took on the aspect of a legend. And
yeah.
In fact, today in occult books, you'll see it referred to, this incident of how the British forces were saved by these ghostly bowmen, as real. I mean, people will say that the authorities tried to cover it up, but the German soldiers were found with arrows in their sides.
Wow. Ted Klein, you must be really fascinated with this because in your award-winning story, Nadelman's God, from the collection Dark Gods, this won an award at the World Fantasy Convention in Providence just recently, you have a portrait of a man who makes up a god, but then the god assumes real proportions. I mean, what a fascinating idea. Gods don't make men. Men make gods.
Yeah, that sort of intrigued me. The sense that when you write something or create something, it sort of gets away from you and does take on a life of its own sort of tickled me. Also, I guess since I'm such a paranoid, the story sort of plays on, I think, a kind of writer's fear of fans. Because in Nadelman's God, a kind of creepy, slightly maniacal fan sort of fastens on the hero, and for his own purposes.
A kind of a play Misty for me of the fantasy world, I
guess.
In fact, I was communicating with you around that time, setting up an interview. And after reading that story, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, here I am sending more letters to Ted Klein. Has anything remotely creepy like that happened to you in correspondence with readers?
Not really. No, I've been very lucky, but that doesn't stop me from always anticipating the worst, because I have a tendency to do that. And so if I get a letter with a strange name and, you know, return address in the mail, I mean, chances are it might be a very nice, friendly, you know, even flattering letter, but I'm always a little uneasy. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe that comes from my years on Twilight Zone. I don't know, where we did run into so many eccentrics.
Ted, tell me about the chronology now, from the ceremonies to the dark gods. Were the sketches, at least for these stories, did they precede the ceremonies at all, or what?
I guess a couple of the stories were written, or I guess three of the stories, in fact, were written before I wrote the novel, and then Nadelman's God, the fourth of the stories, was written afterward. Mm-hmm. So that's the most recent thing that I've had published, except for some articles and so forth.
And how successful has the ceremonies been? And also, what has it done for you in terms of establishing yourself?
Well, it has been, thank God, very successful as a Bantam paperback. It's gone into at least six printings, and there are more than 750,000 copies in print now. And I suppose at some airport somewhere in this great country, it's still, you know, sitting in a paperback rack.
And we should also indicate Dark Gods is also out in paperback.
Right, from Bantam as well.
Now, if people run into first editions of the hardbacks in either case, I assume they'd better grab them.
that's nice of you to say. I don't know, honestly. You know better than I whether, you know, what they're going for, whether they're worth anything.
Well, I've noticed as I was snooping around on your shelves, you have various editions of Ceremonies and Dark Gods that are not available in bookstores, different printings. What's the deal?
Oh, well, I do have the English edition of the Ceremonies, and what you may also be looking at is an anthology called Dark Forces, which came out in a book club edition and an English edition.
No, not that one, but I think there's a bound edition, too, of one of them.
Oh, yes. Well, Viking did something rather nice with the Ceremonies. They sent I guess the first half as a kind of teaser to many booksellers around the country in a kind of paperback, quickly produced edition. And I think those particular editions are fairly rare, but I only have like one myself.
All right, hang on to it. And I'm going to ask you in closing here about two writers quickly that also seem to have been important to you. One is the Gothic novelist, the other is still living. Charles Maturin's Melmoth the Wanderer is a book you cite frequently in the Ceremonies. A massive, extremely intimidating work. Yet, I gather, you think it's worth reading.
Well, it's worth reading if you are going on a long, leisurely sea voyage.
Yeah, this place is around 1820 or so.
Mm-hmm. And it's the kind of Gothic novel that has stories within stories within stories within stories. And it takes place, as I recall, all over the world. It deals in incredible atrocities and sort of on an epic scale. And it's great fun.
You come out of it thinking, I've got to check out what the Spanish Inquisition was all about. What was really going on?
Yeah, right.
Now, the other writer is living now, Fritz Leiber. Stories like Smoke Ghosts, novels like Our Lady of Darkness, really are able to translate Gothic horrors into the modern urban landscape. And I'm wondering if you see him as having been one of several writers who've paved the way for that kind of development.
Yes. I mean, he does that beautifully. But I also admire him because he created The city of is it of the city of 7,000 smokes. I'm thinking of the Lankmar.
Of course. Yeah.
Yes, the city where his Fafhrd and Grey Mouser stories take place. It's a wonderful fantasy city, a sort of mixture, I gather, of Los Angeles and Arabian Nights, Baghdad, and sort of a medieval European city, and it's the perfect setting for tales of adventure and fantasy, with the seedy little taverns and wharves and palaces and thieves' guilds and underground passageways.
Kind of a medieval Innsmouth.
Yes, very much.
Ted, we're about out of time. I just want to ask you if your readers out there will be able to see something else from you soon. You're not resting on your laurels, I hope, from The Ceremonies and Dark Gods.
Well, eventually, the novel that I'm working on now, called provisionally Night Town, should be coming out from Viking. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really sure when.
Are you in a privileged position now with Viking where you can kind of call the shots on when you write and what you write and all of that kind of stuff?
Well, alas, I am well past my deadline, and they don't love that, but they do treat me very nicely.
Talking to Ted Klein, author of Fantasy and Dark Horror, whose novel The Ceremonies has caused such a stir. His collection, Dark Gods, one story at least from that, has already won an award from the World Fantasy Convention this past year, Halloween weekend. And we're broadcasting from the Upper West Side here in New York City. And Ted, I'm so happy not only to meet you, but all of your very odd and eccentric friends hanging from the walls and ceilings.
A pleasure.
So thank you very much. And we'll talk to you again next time here in the Green Room. I'm John Tibbetts. I'll see you then.